So I've got a sermon for you that I think is going to be fun. It's full of little stories about interesting people. Now, if you're a visual learner like me, this is going to be a lot of words. So go to danielharper.org, click on sermon, and you can bring up the sermon and it has pictures to go along with it. And if you don't have a device, come up during the first hymn, I'll give you a little picture book. Because I know this is going to be a lot of words. So, I don't know. I'm just fascinated by history, and you hear these stories. When you do history, you learn stories about these really interesting characters. But in addition to that, I hope to make a serious theological point. In the words of the Unitarian theologian Bernard Loomer, we are born or created as members of a web of interconnections. Okay, that's all the theology for now. Now we're going to go back to history. So to begin this history, you have to understand that we Unitarian Universalists see the relationship between clergy and congregation a bit differently than other religions. Unitarian Universalist congregations don't have to have a minister unless they want to have one. If a Unitarian Universalist congregation does decide that it wants a minister, it is the congregation that chooses which minister. And the congregation is the one that has the power to sever its relationship with the minister. In other words, you guys can fire me and Amy anytime you want. With that in mind, let's take a look at the relationship between our congregation and its ministers from 1947 to the year 2000. So our congregation began in 1947 when Reverend Delos O'Brien, who was then the regional representative of what was called the American Unitarian Association, met with some Unitarians who lived in and around Palo Alto and decided there was enough interest to start a Unitarian congregation here. At that time, the only Unitarian congregations were one up in San Francisco, one down in San Jose. So O'Brien placed advertisements announcing the formation of a Unitarian group and called the first meeting for Sunday, April 6, 1947. So if you want to know our anniversary, that's the year, the date and the year. And the following week, on April 13th, 27 people signed a charter membership roll. By April 27th, the Palo Alto Unitarians had arranged with Nat Laureate, who was then the minister of the San Jose Unitarian Church, to drive up every week on Sunday and lead weekly worship services for them. So this group, which called itself at that time the Palo Alto Unitarian Society, continued in this way for some months, content to remain small with fewer than 50 members. Nat Laureate recalled a meeting in October 1947 where, as he put it, the general feeling was to proceed with great caution and just have a pleasant little group. Laureate wanted to shake them out of that attitude. And he was pleased when the excessive caution at that October meeting produced a reaction among the younger members for more action and growth. So those of you who consider yourselves a younger member, you're the ones with the real power in this congregation. Remember that. Laureate's encouragement of action and growth soon paid off. 60 people attended the first anniversary dinner and voted to form a new congregation, the Palo Alto Unitarian Society. And by late 1948, the congregation had learned about the new minister-at-large program offered by the American Unitarian Association. And one of these ministers-at-large was a guy named Reverend Lon Ray Call, who traveled from place to place across the country, spending 2 or 3 months at each place, building up excitement and enthusiasm, helping set up a congregational organization, and then leaving when he judged the new congregation would survive on its own. He arrived in Palo Alto Easter Sunday, April 17, 1949. Within 1 month, membership had increased from 54 to 102. Years later, lay leader Bob Harrison recalled Lon Call and his wife by saying, "Were they terrific?" With help from the Calls, the congregation saw there was a strong demand for liberal religion in Palo Alto. The Calls also helped the congregation see they would no longer be content to have Nat Laureate coming up just once a week for just an hour on Sundays. The congregation realized they would do best with a full-time minister. They wanted a full-time minister. And so based on Call's recommendation, the American Unitarian Association agreed to pay two-thirds of that new minister's salary. In a historical footnote, for those of you who are interested in alternate history science fiction stories, a few months after Law and Call left Palo Alto, the American Unitarian Association began a new policy encouraging small congregations to form with no professional leadership. These lay-led congregations, called fellowships, needed only 10 members to formally affiliate with the AUA. If the fellowship concept had existed before the Palo Alto Unitarian Society organized in this alternate history, perhaps the Palo Alto Unitarians would have been content to remain at 50 members in rented space, and all those young activists would have gone off somewhere else and formed their own congregation. So I say we owe our current congregation to Nat Laureate's encouragement and to Lon Call's vision of rapid growth. Back to real history. Mid-June 1949, the committee to recommend a permanent minister voted unanimously to extend a call to Nat Laureate, who said, no, I can't do that. The San Jose Church has given me time off so I can come up and preach to you, and I can't turn around and stick it to them. So he turned them down, more politely than I just put it, and the congregation settled on Reverend Felix Danford Lyon, then the minister in Dunkirk, New York. Lon Ray Call wrote to Lyon on behalf of the congregation, encouraging Lyon to accept the position with no in-person interview. They wanted to fast-track this. Call added, "I do not wish to oversell this church, but under the right leadership, it can very quickly become one of our great Unitarian churches." I think some of you here may remember Dan Lyon. You should know that before he came here, he was called Fee, which was short for Felix. He changed his name when he came here. So Lon Call's letter is addressed to Dear Fee. Weird little footnote. In the years from 1949 to 1962, the Palo Alto Unitarian Church, they changed the name from Society to Church in 1951, this congregation did indeed become one of the great Unitarian congregations on the West Coast. Growth happened very quickly. By 1958, the congregation had grown enough to move out of rented space into its own building, built on a cabbage field at the intersection of Charleston Road and Adobe Creek. If you're looking at the pictures on your device, scroll all the way down and there's a picture of that cabbage field. Head pointed that direction and there is nothing from here to the bay except fields. Growth peaked in 1962 when there were 3 Sunday services, 600 children enrolled in the religious education program. Sunday school classes were held in 13 classrooms here on campus, the fireside room right there, which was built as a children's chapel, and living rooms and houses of people who lived nearby. In order to remain at their preferred size of about 500 members, any bigger than that and you lose intimacy, that's what the documents say, the Palo Alto Unitarian Church spun off several smaller congregations, including the Sunnyvale Fellowship. I suspect that your friend was one of the ones who helped form the Sunnyvale Fellowship coming from this congregation. Barbara's nodding. And the Redwood City Fellowship. The theology of both Dan Lyon and most of the congregation might be called vaguely theistic but strongly pragmatic, focused on social issues in the here and now. Dan Lyon reminisced once that there was a point in the late 50s when he wanted to preach a sermon on Red China, which was something that nobody was talking about back then. And people were worried that it was going to impact the growth. It did. They added 15% to the attendance that Sunday, which continued there upwards. Rites of passage were also very important. Dan Lyon officiated at scores of memorial services, child dedications, and weddings. On one landmark day, he did 5 weddings on one Saturday. And a historical footnote, if you know something about the 1960s folk music scene, you'll be interested to know that Dan Lyon officiated at the wedding of a young banjo player named Jerry Garcia, right? And also at the wedding of the really good singer of the Baez family, Mimi Baez Farina, much better than Joan. By the late 1960s, the post-war baby boom was over at the same time that people began to drift away from institutions like churches. Unitarian Universalist congregations across the U.S. declined in membership, and Palo Alto was no exception. By 1965, Sunday school enrollment in our congregation had gone down from its peak of 600 to 500. By 1970, it had dropped to 200. To quote a popular song of the time, the times, they were a-changing. And now the choir is going to sing us another popular song of that time. So, Bruce, I don't know how you picked that. That's like the perfect anthem. Great minds. During the first service, in place of that anthem, we sang one of the hymns that was sung at the very first worship service on April 27th, 1947. And you can look it up, number 190, Light of Ages, Light of Nations. It's a classical four-square hymn. And that's what this congregation was about, was those classic four-square hymns. And you see the early pictures, and you know, all the guys are, I'd be underdressed, because I'm not wearing a suit, right? And then in the late 60s, there's a picture on that website, where's Janet Bulow? There's a picture of Janet sitting on the floor in the fireside room. There's this congregational meeting, and everybody's sitting on pillows on the floor in the late 60s. And Mike Young, who was then assistant minister, is like this, and he's got a beard and a turtleneck. So like there was huge change, cultural change. And that song is one of those cultural changes. Pete Seeger was a lifelong Unitarian, well, through his adulthood, he was a Unitarian Universalist. I don't know why that song's not in our hymnal. That makes me really annoyed. Anyway, getting back to, from this digression, getting back to the sermon. During the 60s, the congregation hired two assistant ministers. The first one, Bud Rep, served as assistant minister from June 1961 to September 1962 while Dan Lyon was on sabbatical. Even though 1962 was peak attendance of the church, they decided that they couldn't afford him. And his salary was so minimal and not raised at the congregational meeting, he left. Then in 1965, they hired Mike Young as assistant minister. Clean shaven when he started out. Within a few years, he had a beard. He was also a campus minister at Stanford, so he wasn't at our congregation full time. He was expected to stay just 2 years, but he stayed for nearly 4 years during his last year being under pressure from the board to find a church of his own. And in 1970, the congregation hired a guy named Ron Garrison as a half-time minister to youth, called a minister, wasn't actually ordained. In 1971, he began working full-time as minister for youth and community education. He helped organize the Thatcher Preschool, which is the preschool that's still on site here now, run by Palo Alto Children's Center. Very innovative concept of the day, providing educational opportunities for young children and also providing daycare for working parents. He also helped organize Lothlorien, which was an alternative high school that for 5 years occupied rooms A through D on our campus. By 1972, the congregation had two full-time ordained ministers, so they cut the funding for Garrison's position to half-time, and he quit. In 1971, Ron Hargis, am I pronouncing that right? Hargis, with a hard G. Hargis was hired as a minister of religious education. See, now I'm getting into dangerous territory because a lot of people here remember what I'm talking about. And I'll just say, I'm pulling this mostly out of documents, and if you want to see the list of documents, it's all on the website. Like, I have a lot of footnotes. So don't blame me. Blame the archives. Hargis later recalled he had arrived at the church in the midst of a real conflict of staff personalities and church people. And a year after Hargis arrived, Dan Lyon resigned to become associate minister at Community Church in New York City. So why did Lyon resign? I'm sure some of you have your own opinions. I'm going to tell you what the archives say. There's a clipping from the Palo Alto Times, which did almost a full page spread on this, saying, "There has been occasional in-house controversy at the church. But members of Palo Alto Unitarian's Board of Trustees say that it is no more than the usual amount, and that it has not been the impetus for Lyon's departure. One trustee, Mrs. Gale, I don't know if you heard that, but it's her mother, said that some criticism was directed at Lyon along the lines that he was perhaps providing too much leadership in church affairs. Close quotation. Other documents in the church archives imply that Lyon was forced out. And with Lyon's departure, Hargis found himself, surprise, surprise, as the sole minister of a large congregation in conflict. Now, back in 2002, when Darcy Lane was the minister of religious education here, interviewed a few people who remembered Ron Hargis, she passed those on to me, and one of the people that she interviewed remarked on the creative ferment that happened during Hargis's tenure. Another remembered him as freewheeling, kind, and gentle, while someone else recalled that his wife would occasionally share the pulpit with him. But another person felt that he, quote, lacked some properties that a good minister should have. In any case, the baby bust continued through the 1970s, so that by 1973, Sunday school enrollment had dropped still further to about 100. In December of 1972, the Board of Trustees hired Sid Peterman to be an interim minister following Dan Lyon's departure. This was a new and experimental concept at the time. After the departure of a longtime minister, a congregation would hire a specialized person to come in for years, someone who specialized in what we now call change management. Peterman later said in an interview that he began doing interim ministry in 1973, so this was his first interim ministry, and he was, I believe, the first Unitarian Universalist interim minister. So we were doing some groundbreaking stuff. When he was ending his interim ministry in late 1973, he wrote eight single-spaced type pages of detailed critical analysis of the Palo Alto Unitarian Church. And in 2002, lay leader Georgia Schwar gave a copy of this report to Darcy Lane. Georgia, when she passed this along to Darcy, Georgia wrote, "Some of the comments in the report are not of current pertinence, but much of it is still surprisingly apropos." I will quote one such comment from Sid Peterman's report that, in my opinion, still applies to our congregation in 2018. "It seems to me," Peterman wrote, "to be quite clear, now that I have been here a year, that some of the internal problems facing this congregation are due to a unique history. Starting in 1949, with a handful of people and almost no possessions, and a budget which was almost 50% underwritten by the American Unitarian Association, Palo Alto Unitarian Church grew by 1970 to be one of the largest churches in the region. All this was done under the strong and effective leadership of one minister who served the church all during this time. Many of the administrative and personnel practices in 1971 were the same as they had been for a much, much smaller church. The developing and inevitable pluralism in the late 60s and early 70s were not taken into consideration, and the result was an enforcement of an artificial dualism which not only caused great individual strains and discomfort, but made the operation of the church far more difficult than it should be. I stress this analysis," Peterson went on, "because to fail to see what really happened in the past dozen years leads up dead-end roads of personalities and recriminations, rather than providing fruitful ways of continuing the growth, both spiritual and physical." Close quote. A historical footnote regarding Peterman. I'd been told by sort of the previous generation of Unitarian Universalist ministers that Peterman was probably gay, although he was someone who kept his personal life very, very separate from his professional life. And this rumor is only worth mentioning because Peterman may have been our first gay minister. 1973, while Peterman was still on staff, the congregation called Bill Jacobson to be a co-minister with Ron Hargis. Since there were those who considered Dan Lyon to have been an autocrat, I suspect for some people this co-ministry idea seemed like a way for two ministers to keep each other in check, sort of like the Supreme Court and Congress. However, the co-ministry idea was not financially viable. Beginning with the 1973 oil crisis, the United States entered a severe economic downturn, and the congregation could not really afford two ministers. In response to the economic downturn, in 1975, both Hargis and Jacobson stated they would automatically, quote, offer their resignations effective January 1st, 1978, if the finances of the congregation did not improve. The finances did not improve. Hargis lived up to his agreement, turned in his resignation. Jacobson said, I think I'll stay. And he stayed on as the sole minister. Not long after arriving at the Palo Alto Unitarian Church, Jacobson got divorced. There are persistent rumors that subsequently Jacobson engaged in what is called sexual misconduct. That is, he allegedly had sex with women in the church, including perhaps teenage girls. Whether or not these rumors are true, I do feel, looking at the documents in the archives, that there's a change in the relationship between the congregation and the ministers from the late 1970s on. Documents from the 50s and 60s show a mutual respect between lay leaders and the senior minister. Tensions, yes, but respect also. By 1990, the documents seem to show a very different relationship between the congregation and its ministers, characterized by a lower level of trust and a tendency to carefully circumscribe the authority of the minister. During Jacobson's tenure, attendance dropped enough that the congregation went back to one service. Nationwide, Unitarian Universalism declined beginning in the mid-60s, beginning to grow again in the 1980s. Here in Palo Alto, it appears that growth didn't really begin again until a decade after that, the 1990s. A September 1998 survey revealed a mixed response to Jacobson. Comments ranged from, I like his sermons, to, the church lacks leadership from our minister. Other comments from this survey questioned lay leadership, such as this one, which really struck me. Many of the lay leaders are quite sexist in their attitudes. In December 1988, Jacobson announced that he was looking for another ministry position. Finally, in August 1990, Jacobson said he'd retire. He then helped form the humanist community of Palo Alto and became executive director there. In 1990, our congregation hired Sam Wright as interim minister. And I'll express my bias here. I think Sam is probably the most interesting minister who served our congregation, even though he was only here for a year. And that's because up until 1998, Wright had lived for two decades in the back country of Alaska, in the Brooks Range. He wasn't there all the time, but he was there a lot of the time. And he lived there with his first wife, Billy. She wrote a book about their experiences there, and after she died, Sam wrote a book about his Alaska experience, which I was told about by Fred Hawley. It's called Kovia Shuvik, and it's in the church library. I think it's a fabulous book. I found it very inspiring. It was published by the Sierra Club as a work of natural history and philosophy. And having read his book, I'd call Wright a mystic in the naturalistic mode of Henry David Thoreau. So one of the few mystics who had remained in the congregation during Jacobson's tenure of very dogmatic humanism told me that they welcomed Wright's arrival and were deeply inspired by him. Wright and his second wife, Donna Lee, considered themselves to be co-ministers. Lee was then in the process of becoming a Unitarian Universalist minister. Lee made a significant contribution to their interim ministry by writing a history of the early Unitarian Church of Palo Alto, which existed from 1905 to 1934. During the year that Wright and Lee served as interim ministers, the congregation added 69 new members. Recovery had begun. After the interim ministry of Sam Wright and Donna Lee, the congregation called Ken Collier as sole minister in 1991. Later, Collier would recall, he was warned away from taking the position here as minister. Quote, I was told the congregation was an aging, tired, isolated and somewhat troubled church that had enormous untapped potential and needed to heal from its recent troubles, unquote. But he saw potential and he came here anyway. Two achievements stand out from the decade when Ken Collier was minister. First, Collier and a small group of lay leaders led the Welcoming Congregation Program. Who was involved in that early Welcoming Congregations Program? That program, for those of you who don't know, was an initiative of the Unitarian Universalist Association designed to undo homophobia and ensure the congregation was a welcoming place for gay, lesbian, and bisexual persons. The congregation's commitment to welcoming gay, lesbian, and bisexual people was soon tested. In 1993, Collier and his then-wife, Marnie, co-wrote a letter to the congregation in which they explained they were getting divorced, saying, quote, "The central issue that we have not been able to resolve is that Marnie has come to realize that she is a lesbian-identified bisexual." Marnie Collier and her new partner remained a part of the congregation. The second major achievement during Ken Collier's tenure was the introduction of the Worship Associate Program, which continues today. Worship associates are lay people who share leadership with ordained ministers in planning and leading worship services. Ironically, today I couldn't find a worship associate. Although, I gotta say, as like a really tall guy, that means I can move the pulpit up where I can actually see the text there. So if you're tall, please become a worship associate. So that worship associate concept is a distinct change from the 50s and 60s when Sunday morning was not a shared responsibility, but rather delegated to the minister. By 1998, effective leadership by Ken Collier and lay leaders had helped the congregation recover from its low ebb in the 1980s. To continue that growth, lay leaders decided it was time to start thinking about adding a second minister. In order to establish the second ministry position, the congregation hired Till Evans, an experienced minister of religious education and sometime faculty member of Star King School for the Ministry, for a two-year interim ministry. Those who remember Evans speak of her with affection. She was described to me as part grandmother and part tiger, depending on what needed to be done. And when a new garden was established next in the McFadden patio, it was named the Till Evans Garden in her honor. By 1999, the congregation had indeed seen enough growth, and members voted to add another Sunday morning worship service. Now remember, there were three services Sunday morning in the 60s. Congregation dropped to one service during the 1980s. Now they were going to go back to two services. The task force charged with adding a second service included both lay leaders and the two ministers. In August 2000, our congregation called Darcy Lane to be the settled minister of religious education and co-minister with Ken Collier. This was the first time since 1927 that there had been a regularly called and regularly ordained woman minister settled in the Unitarian Congregation of Palo Alto. So that old congregation that lasted from 1905 to 1934 had a woman minister, the Reverend Lila Lasley Thompson, whom they ordained and called in 1926. She was the first woman minister called to any Palo Alto congregation, although she had to resign in 1927 when that old congregation could no longer afford to pay her salary. That congregation was defunct by 34. I find myself astonished that after having been such pioneers in women's rights, it took Palo Alto Unitarians nearly three quarters of a century to call another woman minister. I'm not surprised that they were all white. I'm really surprised that they were all men until the year 2000. So Darcy Lane's arrival provides a convenient ending point for this brief history. I'm not the person to tell the rest of the history. I knew Darcy and I was friendly with her. I'm not going to preach about her. I didn't know any of the earlier ministers. But before I end, let me tell you what I was struck with as I was researching this history and writing this sermon. I could not help noticing that the relationship between congregation and ministers was not perfect, not ever. We human beings are fallible. we regularly make mistakes. Some said Dan Lyon took on too much of the leadership of the congregation. Some said Bill Jacobson didn't take on enough leadership in the congregation. You could argue with equal validity that lay leadership during the 50s and 60s took on too little leadership, while lay leaders during the 1980s let themselves take on too much leadership. The relationship was never perfect. We should never forget that human beings are fallible. This is a crucial theological point. Any time a human being thinks they are infallible, they become dangerous. The Lone Rangers, who have no check on their own fallibility, they're the ones we need to worry about. If your mind is instantly going to national politics and Silicon Valley executives, you're right. Ideally, our congregation is a place where our relationships with others protect us from the worst effects of our own fallibility. This, in turn, suggests that fallible humans need to share leadership with one another as the best way to help us through our inevitable mistakes and moments of fallibility. So here we are back to theology. Theologically, what I'm saying is we are part of a web of interconnections. The dimensions of that web are measured by trust, power, gratitude, forgiveness, transformation. And the balance of shared leadership is simply another way to measure the dimensions of the web of interconnectedness that binds each of us together with everyone else and with all of reality.